1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on the greatest rock bands in history. I'm Red Beard, and today in the studio, the biggest selling collection so far in the new millennium gets an extreme makeover.
The Beatles had years of clubs before we ever got any kind of success. So when the time success hit, a record producer would come to us and he'd say, what do you want to record? And we'd say, well, what do you want to hear? You know, we got 8 hours of it, man. Because, you know, after having work in Hamburg, we had about 8 hours repertoire of the Beatles. So for the first few albums, it was really, the first album was done in a day just because it was our stage act.
Paperback Writer!
When we started doing like Paperback Writer and we started doing overdubs, we couldn't perform them on the road at that time. Now you can. You know, like the Beatles were out now, we could have a band backing us up and just have us four in the front. But in those days, you couldn't. We have to try and do all the overdubs at the same time, and it became difficult. You know, Paperback Writer was the first sign I got that, hey, we can't do this anymore.
Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Welcome back. In the studio, I'm Paul McCartney with Redbeard himself.
Ever since its November 2000 release, the Beatles' collection of 27 number one hits has amassed a mind-boggling 33 million copies sold worldwide. In fact, Forbes magazine reported recently that Beatles 1 sells 1,000 copies every week in the U.S. alone. But now, the 27 number one chart-topping songs are being combined with over 200 minutes of beautifully restored music videos, promotional films, and Beatle mini-movies, plus a 124-page book, all collected as a CD, 2 DVD, or Blu-ray set called Beatles 1 Plus. The most popular band of the 20th century, collected into the bestseller so far in the 21st century and pumped up on steroids, is certainly reason enough to revisit Paul McCartney to recall how he, John Lennon, George Harrison, and Ringo, Richard Starkey all first got bitten by the rock and roll bug in Liverpool.
I was at school, you know, we were all just kind of school kids, and up until that point, rock and roll hadn't really broken for us. You know, we were just young. It was like, I don't know how old we were, like 14, 15 or something, you know. Remember then? Yeah. And it was cool, and we'd have a lot of fun in the playground just chatting to each other. We had a little thing called the Smoker's Corner, right, that the teachers weren't supposed to know about. And you went there to have a little sort of, because, you know, 15, we were really thinking we were quite hoody, you know. And we'd all have a, you know, somebody had managed to produce a cigarette or something, and we'd all have a smoke before going to school. Not to be recommended these days. This is before you knew about cancer and stuff. We just thought it was a dead heavy thing to do, you know. And that was the kind of place where I learned all of that, you know. Just somebody would mention Buddy Holly and the Crickets, you know. We kind of go, oh, that sounds good. Who's that, you know? And then on the radio, you started to hear That'll Be the Day. It was really the first. That was the killer. And I still love that record. It's just got a magic sound on it. That's one of the things about Buddy's stuff. You know, I've got some involvement with the publishing now, so I kind of push his work quite a bit around the world. But it's really mainly just because I'm a big fan. It was a big formative influence, you know.
Love Me Do hit number 17 at home in their native UK in 1962, but would later top the US chart 2 years later. Paul McCartney told me that Texan Buddy Holly exerted a fashion influence on at least one Beatle back then.
But his stuff, some of it still sounds innovative. If you listen like Peggy Sue, I mean, I've never heard another record that goes on the drums, so ever since. And, you know, you just sort of think, God, I mean, that's why it all stood out so much. And the harmonies on That'll Be the Day, and Buddy's guitar playing. And that's not even mentioned in his voice and the little sort of, you know, the sort of gimmicks and stuff. So we just fell in love with him, you know. And the other thing that made it really good for some of the guys in the group, particularly when we started to play music, was anyone with glasses was now okay. Because till then, glasses had been death, man. I mean, four eyes, come on, you know, fruitcake. And like this, these were not people you wanted to be associated with. And so John would walk around banging into lampposts, you know, oh, sorry, ma'am, you know, because you had to take these whacking great horn rims off, you know. But then Buddy came into fashion and John wore those things all the time. Then, you know, he could come out of his closet.
Can't Buy Me Love was number one in both the UK and America in April and May 1964. Paul McCartney reminds us that Americans' Buddy Holly and the Crickets' influence extended even so far as to determine the name of the Liverpool Lads band when it was a quintet with Stuart Sutcliffe on bass.
In England, there's the game cricket, so you see, and we knew about the little chirpy, you know, hoppity goes to town type crickets. We knew about them. So we thought they've been brilliant. They've really got this amazing double meaning name of like the game and the bug. So this is great. So we thought, this is brilliant. We thought, well, we've got to do this. So the John and Stuart came up with this name that the rest of us hated. He said, Beatles, but spoke with an A, you know. And we said, well, why, you know? He said, well, you know, because it's a bug and it's got a double meaning, just like the crickets. So we were influenced in many, many ways. And the other big thing was that Buddy wrote his own stuff. Until then, not many people had ever done that. So John and I immediately wanted to write our own stuff because till then we'd just been playing anything we'd ever heard off the radio. And because you heard it off the radio, there was never any time to get the words. So we had some fairly screwed up lyrics. It's great though, nobody knew. You know, at least we'd heard the song. They hadn't even heard the song. But you know, John used to, we used to do Come Go With Me, you know, the Del Vikings, the real early record. And John used to sing, come go with me down to the penitentiary. Hey, you know, like with some old blues song he'd heard somewhere. He took all the sort of, you know, jail prison lyrics off all the other folk songs. Because we didn't know the words, he stuck them in that one. So, yeah, we were very influenced by the States in general.
Hard Day's Night was the title song to the Beatles' first feature film, and it hit number one in both the UK and the US in late July, August 1964. 20 years later, the movie's effect on America's first 24-hour music television channel would be clearly evident on MTV. Prior to his death in November 2001, Beatles lead guitarist George Harrison talked to me about Hard Day's Night.
How did you get that bell-like, that jangly guitar sound originally?
Originally, it was a Rickenbacker 12-string. It was before that which inspired the Byrds was A Hard Day's Night. And some of the songs on that were where I first played the Rickenbacker. Mm. And then Roger McGuinn, he got the Rickenbacker. And then he was doing Tambourine Man and all that. And that song was inspired by one on their first album, which was called The Bells of Rimini. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote that, you know, just to see how many tunes you can come up with that same D shape, you know, basic D chord on the guitar. So many songs written around there. Well, I used it on A Hard Day's Night, and I Should Have Known Better. And I think Norwegian Wood was an acoustic 12-string. Well, it was on a few tracks, but I think the one that really stands out in my mind as the greatest one is Tambourine Man by the Byrds.
8 days a week with John Lennon on lead vocal was number one in the U.S. in March 1965. Next, Paul McCartney explains how these number one hits were honed by years of blood, sweat, and tears. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Sir Paul McCartney for the Beatles Number One Plus Part One.
Welcome back. In the studio, I'm Paul McCartney with Redbeard himself.
Thank you, Paul. It's a real honor. To augment their first three UK hits in late 1962 and early 63, EMI Records staff producer George Martin asked the Beatles to let him hear their repertoire from playing Liverpool's Cavern Club and later the Reeperbahn Red Light District in Hamburg, Germany. Here's Paul McCartney with me in the studio.
The Beatles had years of clubs before we ever got any kind of success. So when the time success hit, a record producer would come to us and he'd say, what do you want to record? And we'd say, well, what do you want to hear? you know, we've got 8 hours of it, man. You know, after having work in Hamburg, we had about 8 hours repertoire of the Beatles. So for the first few albums, it was really, the first album was done in a day just because it was our stage act. But, you know, it did mean that we had masses of material, masses of stuff available. Whereas I think the kids these days, they're lucky if they get one hit song. And then what do you do? How do you follow it up, you know? Whereas we were always aching to follow it up. Yeah, we've got better stuff, man. We wait till the next album. We'll really do this stuff. We'll get into the deep R&B stuff next album. Wow, you know, because our act used to consist of a lot of R&B B-sides. We didn't want to do the A-side because the other groups did the A-sides. So we always did like the B-sides that everyone threw away, but it was still a Bo Diddley song or it was still a Buddy Holly song or something like that. We just, you know, Twist and Shout and all of that. That was just, the only thing we had to do was leave Twist and Shout till the end of the day because we knew John couldn't handle anything after he'd done that. And if you hear the record, it's like he's bleeding his vocal cords. You know, he's right up there, you know.
From the Silver Beatles to the Silver Screen a second time, the title song Help was number one on both sides of the North Atlantic in August and September 1965. Again, Paul McCartney.
There was quite a bit of intelligence in the group. It wasn't like exam-type intelligence, but John was like a smart cookie. And, you know, I wasn't that thick. George, smart cookie too. And Ringo, who like went to school 3 days in his life. That's all he was ever in school, Ringo. He had some operation when he was a kid. He had like peritonitis. And, you know, any parents kind of know what that is. Like, kids die of that stuff. And in those days, this is a stomach thing. And he had this terrible thing. So, I mean, that was his joke, you know. And if everyone used to ask him about school, he said, I only went for 3 days, you know. Like, but he got this kind of worldliness about him, Ringo. He used to say, you know, studied at the University of Life, you know, it was one of those jobs. And it's true. He really is very kind of worldly guy, Ringo. So he kind of held us together in that direction. You know, and then I got into bass. I didn't like it at first, but then I started to see the melodic possibility, so I contributed a bit there. And then with the singing, John and I could always harmonize real good. We blended good. And then we were writing as well, you know. So, like I say, you know, if it was just a straight music contest, probably there were other bands that could beat us, but we always had these other little underlying subtle things that we knew would kind of carry us through.
Ticket to Ride with George Harrison's jangly guitar riff went to number one in the UK and US in April and May 1965, the Beatles' first trip to America. To play the Ed Sullivan TV variety show a year earlier was a welcome distraction to a nation traumatized by the assassination of President John F. Kennedy barely 10 weeks earlier. The Beatles' forward-combed longish hair, tight pants, collarless jackets, and ankle-high black boots seemed to dominate the press reaction, but Paul McCartney reminded me that this was a tight working band.
The Beatles were, like, very special live. And it was, if you just took a straight musical analysis of it, I don't know what we'd score on a scale of 10, you know. I mean, we're always bad at exams, the whole bunch of us. We never did anything, you know, under pressure, we couldn't cut it. But it was more than that. You know, it wasn't just kind of, oh, he's a good guitar player, oh, he's a good drummer, oh, you know, he can play a bit of bass, oh, he sings good. It was the band. That was the great thing about the Beatles, yeah. And I've seen bands that I know are much more musically accomplished than we, as the Beatles, would have ever been. But we always could lick them. We could lick them, man. We never feared anyone. We could go on stage because we knew we'd been together so long. I mean, only in the early days we feared people because it was like, I mean, we used to get beaten by this woman incessantly. She played the spoons. I mean, this woman could just wipe us off any talent show in Liverpool. We used to look out for her. If she was there, we wouldn't go on if she was there. Because, you know, what happens is everyone gets tanked up about it at 11:30 and they go, hey, she's great. She's rattling these spoons. We go, bloody hell, this isn't R&B. But she won every time.
Day Tripper topped the UK chart for 5 weeks at the end of 1965 into January 66. Paul McCartney was humble when he assessed the Beatles as a strictly live band.
I think musically, I think you could have cast your doubts. Certainly Ringo wouldn't have ever played a drum solo for you. Number one, because he hated them, and probably number two, because he couldn't do it. But he hated them. He just hated drum solos, man. The only thing I ever got him to do was on Abbey Road. But he wouldn't have done that. George, I know George doesn't reckon himself as a guitar player. I've talked to him since the Beatles. You know, I said, you're good, man. You've got some great stuff going. He said, yeah, but so-and-so's Clapton's much better, you know. And I suppose if you're doing that kind of musical analysis, maybe Clapton has got, you know, slightly more chops than George. But I don't think that's what it was to do with, you know. I think that, like, the fact that Ringo held tempo great and was a real energetic personality kind of drummer. You know, yeah, that's what I love about drummers. I mean, forget anything else. If they hold time, and particularly these days with clicks and computers, you know, I love a drummer who can just hold time and just doesn't waver, and you've got to play to him. So many drummers will go fast if you go fast and slow if you don't. I hate that. So, you know, we had a lot of little subtle things that really made us good.
The groundbreaking amalgam of Paul McCartney's acoustic ballad with a string quartet, Yesterday, was number one in America in the fall of 1965. Still to come, Paul McCartney with a winter driving tip for when your car's windshield falls out. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear much more of all your favorite rockers at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Sir Paul McCartney for The Beatles' Number One Plus, Part One.
Welcome back. In the studio, I'm Paul McCartney with Redbeard himself.
The pleasure is all mine, Sir Paul. We're looking at the Beatles' number one hits. McCartney reminded me that the camaraderie evident in the movie A Hard Day's Night came purely from shared experience and struggle, making the Beatles truly a band of brothers.
I think that's what became special, was the fact that we were a unit and we played together. And also we knew each other very well through having toured. And, you know, you're touring in the van and the window blows out, a stone hits it on the motorway. And the front, and you're in the British winter, and it's really cold and fog and stuff. And we've got 200 miles to go to get from London to Liverpool. And I mean, talk about like we got to know each other. I mean, this one night I'm talking about, it really was like so cold, you would have just died if we hadn't done something. So what we ended up doing was we lay on top of each other. It's a little beetle sandwich. Literally, four of us lying on the back of this van. But it was the only way we could do it, man, with the body heat. Because we were laughing hysterically as well, which helped. But this, our roadie just had to, you know, pull his hat down over his ears, man, and drive with this windscreen out, you know. So, you know what, all of those times when you get like a tough thing or a hard gig or something to do, or a big Royal Variety performance or something, or America the first time, you know, these things are like nerve-wracking. The fact that we knew each other so well.
Penny Lane was number one in the U.S. in February 1967. By this time, Beatlemania was at full gallop, and big hits make you a big target. Unprecedented success spawned unprecedented scrutiny by parents bewildered by the Beatles' Pied Piper appeal to their kids. And since these parents didn't understand the appeal, they feared it. Again, Paul McCartney.
I always used to hate that feeling, because people used to say to us in the early Beatle days, you know, do you feel responsible because there's kids out there screaming and staying out late because of you and all this? And I was saying, I hate that idea. Why am I responsible for them? I'm just some singer, you know. But of course, you know, as you grow up and then you get kids of your own and you start to realize what those parents were worried about.
Models, right?
Yeah, you know, they're kind of worried about that. And I can see it now with kids of my own. I still wouldn't figure any entertainer was responsible for my kids' well-being. That's me. That's the parents, right. You know, or the kids themselves.
Right.
But I do understand a little bit more now.
Paperback Writer, a truly innovative subject for a pop song, went to number one in both the UK and US in June and July 1966. But the Beatles were writing, recording, making movies, and touring at such a breakneck pace that something had to give. The late George Harrison told me that with Paperback Writer, it became clear to him what the Beatles had to do.
Every album I've ever made, I write the tune, I record it, and that's it. I listen to it during the mixing and maybe up until the point where, you know, it's been out for a week or so, and then that's it.
But do you agree that that's definitely not the norm for most musicians?
Most of them are working bands, and they just go in, record, like we used to do in the early 60s. Make an album and off you go on the road. But that wasn't the way I did it. And when we started doing like Paperback Writer and we started doing overdubs, we couldn't perform them on the road at that time. Now you can. You got all the machines that make all the noises. You got two keyboard players and three guitar players. And, you know, like if the Beatles were out now, we could have a band backing us up and just have us four in the front. But In those days, you couldn't. We have to try and do all the overdubs at the same time, and it became difficult. You know, Paperback Writer was the first sign I got that, hey, we can't do this anymore.
Again, utilizing a string quartet brilliantly with a pop song, Eleanor Rigby became number one in the UK in August and September 1966. Though the Beatles played their final concert in San Francisco that year, Paul McCartney has proven to be the Dorian Gray of rock and roll by playing live frequently into the 21st century.
And I must say, I'm really enjoying it. You know, it's something that I'm used to. I know, you know, it's just kind of natural to me. And the real great thing, as you say, I don't need to do it to eat. But in a way, kind of spiritually, the feedback you get from the audience is very special. I mean, you make your records for the guy or the girl to put on when they get home, you know, whether it is they've got a vinyl CD or in the car or something. And you always make your records with that person in mind, kind of, you know, the fictitious listener that you're trying to please. So when like 50,000 of them show up all at once, it's pretty like overwhelming. It's like, here they all are. And somebody I was talking to said, we were all hugging each other. He said, I was saying, well, you know, I don't ask you to do that, you know, but they just feel like that. So it really is very powerful.
Paul McCartney returns the same day and time next week in the studio for Beatles Number One Plus Part 2. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest Paul McCartney, who returns next week in the studio. And God rest the soul of George Harrison. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter. Great theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, @RedbeardRocks, and online at inthestudio.net.